Professor Zinn is Professor Emeritus at Boston University. He is a radical historian in the true meaning of the word radical, from the Latin radic, meaning root or foundation. He is author of numerous books, including A People's History of the United States, as well as The Zinn Reader, at fine bookstores everywhere, or, in my opinion, the finest bookstore, Lucy Parsons Center, 549 Columbus Avenue. And there is a new edition out by Southend Press of his play. Did you know he was a playwright as well? Marx in Soho. He has recently received the Lenin Foundation Literary Award for Nonfiction, the Eugene Debs Award, and the Sacco and Vanzetti Award for his writing and political activism. Please join me in welcoming Professor Howard Zinn.
Tired of sitting, huh? Thank you. Can you all hear me back there? Can you? Okay. Can you hear me? Yeah. Louder. How's this? Okay. Well, I'm happy to be here on behalf of Food Not Bombs, one of my favorite organizations. I don't have too many favorite organizations, maybe 100. In all those organizations that send me mail and email and all of that. But Food Not Bombs is a very special group. I've known them for a long time, and almost everywhere I go, I see them. Hard to get rid of them, but you can arrest them. Out in California, they get arrested very often. And I was out in San Francisco, right? Isn't there San Francisco, you know, that great city? They arrest these people for distributing food. If they were distributing bombs, no problem. That's what we do all the time. It's legitimate. But food, no. It's a great group, and they deserve our support. And I understand that you lost a lot of your resources. And, of course, they have enormous resources. But whatever resources they have, you lost a lot of them in one of the recent demonstrations. Is that true?
No. In
D.C. In D.C.? Ah, yeah. Well, anyway, that was the immediate cause for somebody calling me up and saying in a desperate tone, you know, they've taken everything we've got. They exaggerate a little. And we desperately need help, and so will you help us out? So here I am. It's not hard to come to Harvard Square. Good coffee. And food, if you pay for it. So, I said I would talk on the myth of the Cold War, and sometimes I talk about what I say I will talk about. And in fact, I will talk about the myth of the Cold War. Can you still hear me? Oh, okay. Speakers don't like a word to be missed. So, here's what I mean by the myth of the Cold War. Maybe you actually know what I mean. In that case, you don't have to listen to the rest of this. Let me tell you what I mean by the myth of the Cold War. I mean that, there's a certain sort of standard orthodox view of the Cold War. And that is, it's something that started probably, you know, right after World War II. 1945, 1946, continued until 1989, when the Soviet Union began to disintegrate, and that was the period of the Cold War. Well, some people date it differently. That is, George Kennan at one point said that the Cold War really began at the time of the Bolshevik Revolution, and not immediately after the Bolshevik Revolution, but shortly after the Bolshevik Revolution, when Lenin dissolved the Constituent Assembly. And those of you who know something about Russian history, and I can tell by this very sophisticated group, that you know a lot about Russian history. And you know that, you know, there was a Constituent Assembly which had a number of different political groups in it right after the revolution. Lenin dissolved the Constituent Assembly and established a kind of, you know, one-party system. I hate to say that, because you know we're in favor of a two-party system, and which is one more than a one-party system. And so the argument is, when Lenin dissolved the Constituent Assembly, well, that was infuriating, because that was a blow at democracy. And as Kennan put it, Woodrow Wilson, you know, was president, you know, at that time, and he said Wilson was shocked by the dissolution of the Constituent Assembly. What does that mean? That before that, Wilson welcomed the Bolshevik Revolution. You see, but once Lenin dissolved the Constituent Assembly, no. Because, as Kennan said, Wilson had a strong attachment to constitutionality. Now, this was a few years after 1,000 Americans had been put in jail for speaking out against World War I. But Wilson did not exactly have a strong attachment to the First Amendment during wartime, you see, but he did have a strong attachment in general to constitutionality, just so long as you didn't get too specific. For instance, a few weeks after Lenin dissolved the Constituent Assembly, Woodrow Wilson dissolved the Haitian National Assembly. Now, you might ask, what has Wilson got to do with the Haitian National Assembly? The answer is a lot, because the United States begins its occupation of Haiti, you see, in 1915, and is there, you know, until 1933. And so at this time, the United States, you might say, yeah, is the occupying force in Haiti, as in charge of Haiti, and the United States does not like the fact, and as I say, this happens, you know, right after Lenin's dissolution of the Constituent Assembly. The United States doesn't like the fact that the Haitians refused to ratify a constitution for Haiti written by the United States, which is very impolite. And Franklin D. Roosevelt, in fact, I know Roosevelt has a lot of fans and so on and so forth, and I always hate to say negative things about people that we like a little. And so Roosevelt, but the fact is Roosevelt, you can put this up to youthful impetuosity or whatever, but Roosevelt wrote the Constitution for Haiti, and it was very disappointing that they wouldn't accept it, because the Constitution allowed American corporations to snap up whatever land they could in Haiti, and the Haitians refused this, and so Wilson dissolved the Haitian National Assembly because of his attachment, as Kennan said, strong attachment to constitutionality. Anyway, my point is that presumably the Cold War and all the things that happened in the Cold War, well, certainly all the things the United States did during the period of the Cold War, were based on the fact that there was a Soviet threat. Maybe it started in 1917 or 18 or 19. Certainly much, much more threatening after 1945, when the Soviet Union has been, you know, you might say, the major military victor in World War II. and the Soviet Union emerges after World War II, although it's sort of economically and militarily decimated in many ways, but it emerges out of World War II a great power. And so after 1945, the Soviet Union is second to the United States as a great power in the world, and that's what then, you know, the Cold War is about. And all the things that we do after 1945, from 1945 to 1989, we do because of the communist threat to the world. Because in 1945, Henry Luce, some of you may know that name, Henry Luce was the owner of Time, Life, one of the great media moguls of this century, the owner of Time, Life, and Fortune. I mean, not only the magazines, but the things themselves, you see. And Luce pronounced in 1945, before there was really even too much of an opportunity to see what the Soviet Union was doing with its newfound power, Henry Luce pronounced this as the American century, the century in which the United States would become a preeminent in the world. So there followed, as I say, this long period between 1945 and 1989 of the Cold War, you know, based on a Soviet threat. Now, it's true that the Soviet Union, and nothing that I tell you should diminish the recognition the Soviet Union became a dictatorship. What you have to do is read Khrushchev's speech to the 20th Party Congress, which I know you're just about to do as soon as you leave this place. I don't have to talk about Stalinism or not Stalinism did. And it's true the Soviet Union moved into Eastern Europe and asserted its power over a number of countries in Eastern Europe. So, yes, there was a Soviet Union. The Soviet Union was doing those things. The only question is whether it was those things that caused the United States to do all the things that it then did in the world until 1989. The Soviet Union offered, I say this not as an example of the Soviet Union being a great peace-loving power, but the fact is it was to the interests of the Soviet Union slow things down if there was going to be a great, fierce race between the United States and the Soviet Union. The Soviet Union offered, after World War II, to unify Germany. You know, there's all this business of the wall went down. Germany is unified. Great thing. It should be unified, East and West. But the Soviet Union offered to a unified Germany so long as it would be disarmed, neutral, not allied with any one side or the other. But the United States rejected it. There was a I don't know if I can. Walter Beadle Smith, who was the ambassador to the Soviet Union in 1947, said, "In spite of our announced position, we really do not want nor intend to accept German unification in any terms the Russians might agree to, even though they seem to meet most of our requirements." He didn't say this publicly, but you have to always see what do people say publicly and what do they say privately? What do they say at the time and what do they say later? The Cold War proceeds, and the United States engages in this period of the Cold War, and as I said, yes, the Soviet Union sends troops into Czechoslovakia and later to Hungary and in other countries of Eastern Europe. And what is the United States doing in the meantime? The United States is fighting a war in Korea, between 1950 and 1953, a very, very bloody war, a much neglected war, that is a war that, you know, people have forgotten about, but a war in which several million Koreans were killed, but presumably it was a war to stop communism, had something to do with the Soviet Union, possibly with China. But several million Koreans were killed in that war, and at the end of that 3 years of warfare, Korea was exactly where it was before. There's a North Korea, a dictatorship, South Korea, a dictatorship, only all those people were dead. But this was one of the first things that happened in, well, a Cold War that became hot for those 3 years. And the Cold War included non-wars, almost wars, and real wars, all sorts of wars. And 1953 was the year in which the United States, through the CIA, arranged the overthrow of the government in Iran. Had something to do, I know this will surprise you, had something to do with oil. It's always surprising to think what oil and the possession of oil means to people in high places. But government in Iran, government Mossadegh, had nationalized oil fields. Nothing more infuriating than when a government nationalizes any properties, takes it out of the realm of free enterprise, the market, American corporations. And so when Iran did this, that government could not stand. And so the government was overthrown, and our friend the Shah came back. We like Shahs. Even when the Shah was overthrown by the revolution, we still had a fondness for him and tried to take care of him, even when he's gone. We have this predilection for taking care of deposed dictators and tyrants. And out of sympathy, humanitarianism. The year after this coup in Iran, the United States organizes another coup in Guatemala. Now, you might say, was it communism in Iran? No, it wasn't communism in Iran. It was oil. I say this because presumably all the things we did in the Cold War had to do with communism in the Soviet Union. No, it was oil. And what about Guatemala? Was it communism? No. It was United Fruit. That's what it was about. Because what happened in Guatemala was that, something really troubling happened. They had a free election. And the United States has always been in favor of free elections, except when they don't go our way. And the election in Guatemala did not go our way because the man elected was a man named Arbenz. He was not a communist, but he knew communists. Try not to know communists. It will get you in trouble. Let's put it this way. He didn't put communists in jail. He hardly put anybody in jail, really. It was quite a democratic government. But the sin that he committed was that he took back the lands of United Fruit, which United Fruit had taken, a radical might say, stolen from the people of Guatemala. Let's say taken from the people of Guatemala. Now, Arbenz, as I say, he was not a communist. He was not a revolutionary. If he was a revolutionary, he would have taken back the lands from United Fruit and said goodbye. No, he offered to pay United Fruit for the land. That seems rather wimpy to me. It doesn't seem like a revolutionary, but still, he did it. He offered them. He offered to pay them the value of the land as they had estimated it for tax purposes. That wasn't fair. And so the United States went to work. The State Department went to work. Eisenhower's secretary went to work. She had a tie with United Fruit. Dulles Brothers went to work. All sorts of people went to work. There's a man who wrote a memoir about this, who was a PR man for the United Fruit Company at the time. His name was Thomas McCann. And he's written a book about that, about how the United States built up the threat of communism in Guatemala in 1954 to justify the fact that the United States secretly armed an invasion force in Guatemala, which overthrew Arbenz and established a military regime which lasted for a very, very long time and which killed an enormous number of people, mostly indigenous people in Guatemala. So not communism in Guatemala either, but United Fruit. And so the Cold War, continues to, unroll, and things happen more and more. The Bay of Pigs, Castro Revolution, 1959, and that was intolerable because the United States was accustomed to running Cuba. Oh, really? We had been accustomed to it for a long time. We've been accustomed to doing that since 1898. That's 61 years. So that's a long habit, hard to break. And here Castro was asking us to do it cold turkey. And very soon after Castro takes power, the United States, you may or may not know the Bay of Pigs. It's amazing how things happened very recently. A lot of people don't know about them. But you probably know about the Bay of Pigs, and you know that the United States secretly planned and armed and financed and an invasion of Cuba, which failed because they expected the Cuban people to rise up and salute the American flag, pledge allegiance, and sing the Star Spangled Banner, and overthrow Castro. And the people did not at all rise up against Castro, but Castro was a very, very popular revolutionary leader. His popularity may have declined somewhat since then, but at that point he was a very popular revolutionary leader. The revolution failed. The invasion failed. Presumably the invasion was undertaken because of communism. But what did Castro represent communism? Castro represented much more than communism. He represented a country in Latin America independent of American control. Now, that was a key to many of the things the United States did in the Cold War. Many things that the United States did during this period of the Cold War presumed to be actions against communism and communist countries and communist revolutions were actually actions against countries that wanted to be independent of the United States or were going to throw out the influence of American corporations like Iran and Guatemala. But communism was a presumed reason for all of this. And so there's the Bay of Pigs in 1961. And then, of course, in the meantime, the United States has been getting involved more and more and more in Indochina, Vietnam, Laos, Cambodia. The United States, the French have been fighting for years since the end of World War II, since 1946, to reestablish French control over their old colony, to which independence has been promised by the great powers, in the jubilation of World War II and victory and all of that. Yes, no more colonialism, independence for colonial countries, but no, when France wanted to reestablish its control over its colony, the United States, went along. And, presumably because the opposition to France, the independence movement, was led by a communist. But did communism, even if the communist-led independence movement in Vietnam won all of Vietnam, did this mean that communism would be a threat to the United States? This communism in charge in this little peninsula at the tip of Southeast Asia, did communism victorious there mean that there would be a threat to the United States? I mean, all you have to do is look at the map and look at the size of Vietnam and look at the size of the United States and then look at the size of China, which was already a communist country. And China is there. That's a communist country, you see. Vietnam is a little communist country. But when you look at the memos that went back and forth in the 1950s, when the United States is giving aid to France, supplying most of the military might for the French to try to defeat the Vietnamese independence movement, you look at the memos that go back and forth between the State Department and the National Security Council, all the National Security memos, what do they talk about when they talk about why the United States is involved in Indochina, in Vietnam, in Southeast Asia? They don't talk about communism. They talk about tin, oil, and rubber. That's what really concerns the United States government about the control of this region. It doesn't matter who controls it, the communists, non-communists. The question is it going to be us or is it going to be someone else, whether they're communist or not? And if it was someone else going to be controlling the tin, rubber, and oil, then the United States is going to do what it can to stop that. And so we go into, as you know, a long and brutal war in Vietnam. And while the words that come out of the president and out of the secretary of state and the congressman and all of that about why we're fighting for freedom and democracy and self-determination, but privately into small groups, they're saying other things. And Kennedy, early in the game, is saying, Vietnam is an important piece of real estate. It's a game of monopoly that's going on in the world. Every part of the world is an important piece of real estate. The Soviet Union wants to get what it can in Eastern Europe. The United States wants to get what it can wherever. And each using the other to justify what it's doing. These are the actions that take place during the Cold War, and it goes on, and of course, while the war is going on in Vietnam, the United States engineers a coup in Chile. There too, as in Guatemala, certainly similar circumstances. A president is elected in Chile whom the United States doesn't want. Free election. We love free elections, but no, Allende, elected freely, is not our man. He's not the man of Anaconda Copper. He's not the man of IT&T. And so when he's elected, and the United States, by that time, secretly has worked undercover to try to make sure he isn't elected, but he is elected. When he's elected, he doesn't establish a Marxist dictatorship. It's sort of a left-of-center regime and so on. But the United States goes to work. Kissinger is an important figure in this, head of something called the 40 Committee, which has, Plan A and Plan B. Plan A, you try to undermine the regime economically. Plan B, if Plan A doesn't work, then you're going to have to do something more drastic. All of this is very specifically laid out in a report to, of all places, Senate Committee on Intelligence, which in 1975 investigates the CIA and the FBI, and in those volumes of testimony before the committee is an amazing amount of stuff, which is very embarrassing to the United States for what it reveals about its motives and about its actions and about its violations of law and so on. So, yes, Allende is overthrown, and there, as in Guatemala, a military dictatorship is installed, which then is friendly to the United States and which gets help from the United States and proceeds to butcher thousands and thousands of its people. And all this in the name of stopping communism. All this is accompanied by, of course, domestically, the use of the communist threat as a reason for security measures. Because if you're engaged in a war against communism, against the Soviet Union, then you have to make sure that you don't have people at home who are going to get in the way of what you're trying to do, or people who are going to possibly organize against what you're trying to do. And so what we have then is what some people call McCarthyism, but really doesn't deserve to be named that way because it's a phenomenon that goes beyond McCarthy. It wasn't Senator McCarthy. It was everybody in government. It was Truman before it was McCarthy. It was Truman instituting the loyalty oaths in 1947 before McCarthy comes on the scene in 1950. It's the House Un-American Activities, committee which goes to work. It's the FBI with its millions of files on all sorts of Americans, with a secret memo. Well, this person, this person attended a Paul Robeson concert and applauded. Let's see. This is the kind of thing that is going on. And accompanied by kind of hysteria, where the word communism becomes an excuse for doing all sorts of things, and where threats are magnified and lies are told. Lies are told under Eisenhower, under Kennedy, under every administration, always with the exaggeration of Soviet power, because you have to convince the United States that although we have the Atlantic Ocean on one side and the Pacific Ocean on one side, and Mexico and Canada are not particular military threats, you have to persuade the people of the United States that this, is a real, military threat. Interestingly enough, and General MacArthur, who, a militarist and war maker and who in the Korean War wanted to push right to the edge of China and created a great commotion. But after all of that, MacArthur sort of settled down. I don't know why. But, very often people come out of government, people who've been, look at McNamara. They're people who sort of get contrite or half contrite. And they talk about it. They say, no, that was wrong, And they look at what people are doing now, and they say, no, I was foolish then, too, And so MacArthur he becomes kind of anti-militarist. MacArthur says in 1957, our government has kept us in a perpetual state of fear with the cry of grave national emergency. Always there's been some terrible evil at home or some monstrous power that was going to gobble us up if we did not blindly rally behind it by furnishing the exorbitant funds needed. He's touching on something interesting there. Furnishing the exorbitant funds needed. Is it possible that they created this monstrous power so that we could build up an enormous military establishment which requires huge military contracts for billions and billions of dollars, and that there are people, corporations, who are going to profit from this? I mean, MacArthur doesn't spell that out, but it's sort of suggested in what he says. And when he talks about the, perpetual state of fear. Now, there's the bomber gap under Eisenhower. The Russians have all these bombers. Well, they didn't. They had a few bombers, which they flew over and over again in the same place, you see. And our spies, I guess, are poor counters, you see. And they counted. Every time the same bombers appeared, they counted them all up, you see, and added up to a lot of bombers. Now, Soviet Union never could come close to matching the enormous military power of the United States. But there was called a bomber gap, immediately a rush to build more bombers by the United States. And then there was a missile gap at the beginning of the Kennedy administration. The fact is, and McNamara conceded this later, when he was Secretary of Defense, he said, the Pentagon insisted there was a missile gap. Russians had all these missiles. The United States had far, far, far more missiles than the Soviet Union, but it didn't matter. We had to build more and more missiles. And so all sorts of hysterical things went on. I'm thinking of the fact that, well, under Reagan, things got a little fantastic. But Reagan always was seeing movies in his head, you see, and they were not documentaries. And Reagan, toward the end of Reagan's administration, and Reagan was, and this is, very important part of the Cold War in the 80s, all of the military aid to El Salvador, all the military aid, to Guatemala, all the military aid to the counter-revolutionaries, people who were trying to overthrow the Sandinista government, and all of this accompanied, by helping death squads, which were killing huge numbers of people in El Salvador and Guatemala, and other countries. And this is happening during the Reagan administration, but all presumably because of the threat of communism. Communism in El Salvador, communism in Nicaragua, communism in Guatemala. These are all little countries. However, don't mistake the situation. They may be little countries, but they're not that far away. See, Reagan told newspaper publishers in a speech, quoted Lenin, because, Reagan was a great fan of Lenin's writings. Quoted Lenin. According to Reagan, Lenin said, "The road to America leads through Mexico." Now, after this, people scrambled through all of Lenin's collected works. You see, because, Reagan did a great favor for the communist movement because it led to all these people reading Lenin. To see where Lenin had said this about, the road to America leads through Mexico. Nobody could find anything in all of Lenin's voluminous writings, you see. So, it was a movie about Lenin that Reagan had in his head. At another point when he was explaining why we were sending arms to Nicaragua, saying, Nicaragua is 2 hours flying time to Texas. Well, that's troubling, because the Nicaraguans are going in their fleet of planes to fly to Texas. Once in Texas, they're not far. There's Amtrak. And you say, "Well, Reagan, he's, we know Reagan, not." Well, I don't want to say what I should, what people think about Reagan. People thought he was not an intellectual giant. Let's put it that way. But there were people who thought Kissinger was an intellectual giant. You see, They had the same policies. It's interesting how intellectual pygmies and intellectual giants very often have the same policies, you see. And at one point, Kissinger said, well, you know, there, down there in the Caribbean is the soft underbelly of the United States. Trying to figure an anatomical chart, you know, and try to see exactly what that meant. But you know, the people who say these things, they don't think that people are going to go to Lenin's works. They don't think that people are going to look at anatomical charts. They think that people are just going to be emotionally aroused by those words and fearful enough to vote another $300 billion military budget with another huge sum of money for the armed forces and another good reason for being suspicious of people around you who are disloyal, you know, to American foreign policy. Well, so I'm suggesting that this period of the Cold War, which includes a very large number of American military forays all over the world, and a very large amount of American military aid to terrible governments all over the world. I mean, I've left out the Philippines and Indonesia and places in Africa, you know, that the United States wanted to support militarily because, you know, we wanted them on our side, no matter who they were, you see. And, but so there's something mythological about all of these acts of the Cold War being due to the communist threat rather than what seems more likely, that all of these acts were due to the desire to expand militarily, politically, economically. And I would argue that a simple test of that proposition, that is a simple test of proposition that, no, it wasn't economics and it wasn't politics, it wasn't desire for expansion, it was because of the Soviet threat. The test of that is, what was the United States doing before 1917? That is, before the Bolshevik Revolution, before there was a Soviet threat. Presumably before 1917, the United States was a benign presence in the world and minding its own business and just doing good things in the world. But, you know, it doesn't take too much history to see that the United States before 1917 and before the period of the Cold War, was doing very much the same things that it was doing during the period of the Cold War, during the existence of the Soviet Union. I mean, starting from way back, starting with the continental expansion of the United States from a thin, straggling bunch of colonies along the East Coast all the way across to the Pacific. And down to the Gulf of Mexico, an expansion which involved a number of wars, which involved the Mexican War, which involved hundreds of wars against Indian tribes, which lived in that area, lived in that enormous expanse which was called the Louisiana Purchase, in which looked on the blackboard when your teacher showed you proudly that the United States had doubled its territory in 1803 by the acquisition of the Louisiana Purchase, and, you know, empty land, except that there were all these people who lived there, you see. And these people had to be destroyed in order for the United States to occupy that land. So there's a long, bloody history of a continental expansion long before there's a Soviet Union. And then, people do know that in 1898, the United States, and it sort of became a world power. There are even chapters in American history books labeled The Age of Imperialism, which goes from 1898 to 1902. You see. Something, you know, a period that we sort of fell into, but quickly discarded, you see. But 1898, you know, because that was the war with Spain, you know, over Cuba. But of course, before 1898, even before 1898, there was a continental expansion. And before 1898, there were even forays overseas. A lot of people think that, oh, Cuba, first time the United States moved out from continental expansion and went, you know, across waters to other countries. No, that's not so. There was let me see if I can find what I'm looking for. I told you about the Bay of Pigs. Well, in 1962, the Secretary of State, Dean Rusk, appeared before a congressional committee because, you know, the Bay of Pigs had failed. The United States doesn't like to fail. But we've failed in overthrowing the Castro government, and when we fail at something, there's got to be an investigation. And so there was an investigation. And Dean Rusk, the Secretary of State, appears before a congressional committee and saying, and asking sort of very innocently, why are we doing that? Why are we invading Cuba? If we had succeeded, they wouldn't have asked that question. But we failed. So they asked the question, why did we try to invade Cuba? And Rusk says, don't get excited. I'm paraphrasing, you understand. Rusk, I like to paraphrase these guys because they don't talk this way. But essentially, Rusk said, why get excited? This isn't the first time the United States has intervened in the affairs of other countries overseas. And he produces a list, which the State Department researchers had prepared for him. And the list says between 1798... between 1798 and 1895, that is before the Spanish-American War, between 1798 and 1895, there were 103 interventions in the affairs of other countries. Well, you didn't learn about that in your history books. I didn't learn about that in my history books. They weren't huge things. They're just, you know, Marines landing in Argentina in the 1850s, Marines landing in Nicaragua also in the 1850s. And also the State Department gives reasons for these interventions. You know, Argentina, Marines were landed and maintained in Buenos Aires to protect American interests during a revolution. 1853, Nicaragua, to protect American lives and interests during political disturbances. We don't like political disturbances. 1853, the opening of Japan. I always love that. The opening of Japan. That was the beginning of free trade. And the opening of Japan. And you may know that this involved the use of warships to force Japan to open its ports to the United States. That was called the opening of Japan. And 1854, again, in Nicaragua, a town in Nicaragua is destroyed, and this is the State Department language, to avenge an insult to the American minister to Nicaragua. An insult. Well, Uruguay, China, Angola, Hawaii, again in Nicaragua in the early 19th. Well, the point is a lot of interventions before the Spanish-American War. And then, of course, in 1898, Spain. Go to war with Spain over Cuba, presumably to liberate Cuba. In fact, there's been a revolution going on in Cuba. Spain has controlled Cuba for a very, very long time. Almost, you might say, since Columbus, really. But there's been several revolutions against Spain by the Cubans who want to get Spain out of there and run their own country. In 1895, a very serious revolt starts in Cuba against Spain, and that revolt is going quite full force. In 1898, the United States goes to war against Spain, as I say, presumably to liberate Cuba. Just before that invasion, there's a kind of ideological preparation that goes on in the United States, I think there's almost an exact quote. You know, Theodore Roosevelt says, this country needs a war, almost any war. And at this time, sort of, Henry Cabot Lodge is making statements about, you know, the, you know, how, I don't know if I have it here, but Henry Cabot Lodge is saying, that in the interests of our commerce, we should build a Nicaragua canal. This is just before the Spanish-American War. And for the protection of that canal and for the sake of our commercial supremacy in the Pacific, we should control the Hawaiian Islands and maintain our influence in Samoa. And when the Nicaraguan canal is built, the island of Cuba will become a necessity. Not talking about liberating Cuba from Spain. He's talking about Cuba becoming a necessity for the United States. And in fact, of course, that was the situation. The United States wanted Spain out of Cuba, not to liberate the Cuban people, but to take over Cuba, and that's exactly what happened. There was fear that the Cuban rebels would overthrow Spain, and they would create their own independent government without the United States in there, and furthermore, there was fear that this government might be a black government. A lot of black people in Cuba. Same fear had been expressed when Haiti, you know, the first black republic in the Western Hemisphere, 1803, when Haiti had rebelled and overthrew French rule in Haiti and established a black republic. The United States would not recognize it. Jefferson was president, and the Declaration of Independence was long gone. And Jefferson would not recognize the Haitian Revolution. Because for one thing, a black republic, when there's still slavery in the United States, what signal is this to black people, to black slaves in the United States? And so in Cuba, that's a big worry. In fact, Winston Churchill writes an article. He's a young, you know, writer, imperialist, even at an early age. I think at the age of 3, Churchill was, you know, an imperialist. And Churchill, I don't know if I can find I don't have to. You'll have to take my word for it. And besides, even if I, you know, claim to be reading a quote, you'd still have to take my word for it. People make up quotes all the time. You know. So, Churchill was worried about that. And the United States was worried about that. And the United States used the excuse of the blowing up of the Maine. Somebody might say, in Havana Harbor, somebody might say, what was the Maine doing in Havana Harbor? Don't ask. You know, what was this destroyer doing out there in the Middle East? It's interesting, with all this, you know, the Americans killed and so on, I haven't heard anybody on television or the radio ask, what were we doing there? You know? What, you know, nobody. No. I mean, how does the Vietnam War start with the Gulf of Tonkin resolution? North Vietnamese PT boats have attacked American destroyers in the Gulf of Tonkin. I mean, there were no casualties. They couldn't find any casualties. They couldn't find any damage. They could only find, later on, lies told about it. But that became the occasion, for, they've attacked our destroyers. And nobody asked at the time, what are our destroyers doing off the coast of North Vietnam? Do you know where North Vietnam is? It's not right next to San Francisco. It's far, very far away, But the battleship Maine blows up, and the Spaniards must have done it. In the 1960s, by the way, they never found out what blew up the battleship Maine. In the 1960s, an investigation led by Admiral Rickover, U.S. Navy, investigation finds the Maine blew up because of an internal problem with the engines in the Maine. But a little late. By then, we had already landed in Cuba. Theodore Roosevelt was already marching up San Juan Hill, crawling up San Juan Hill, running up San, who knows? But he was riding on his horse, up San Juan Hill. And we quick victory in Cuba. 3-month war, splendid little war, they called it. 3-month war, very few American, about 5,000-something American casualties, many, many more Spanish casualties. Of these 5,000 American casualties, only about 350 were battle casualties. The other American dead were victims of food poisoning because of poisoned beef, rotten beef, sold to the Army by the meatpacking houses of Chicago, Swift and Armour. It's war, and that's what happens. When we defeat Spain in Cuba, the rebels want to come into Havana. No, our army keeps them out of Havana. The Cubans want to create their own constitution. No, you can't create your own constitution until you accept an amendment saying that the United States has the right to intervene in Cuba anytime it wants, something called the Platt Amendment. The Cuban Constitutional Convention rejects the Platt Amendment. There are huge demonstrations in Havana. The United States says, sorry, if you don't accept the Platt Amendment, we're just going to stay here. Our army is just going to stay here. The Platt Amendment goes into the Constitution, and from that point on, the United States does, in fact, intervene in Cuba again and again and again, as it intervenes in other places in Latin America again and again and again, in the Caribbean. In every country in the Caribbean. Occupation force in Haiti, occupation force in the Dominican Republic for 10, 15, 20 years. And from Cuba, we go on to the Philippines. Cuba is a short war. The Philippines is a long war, bitter, bloody, full of atrocities, a precursor, really, of the Vietnam War. With massacres, with the killing of civilians, it's a war to prevent the Filipinos from running their own country because they're not civilized enough, they're not Christianized enough, according to President McKinley, to run their own country. So we fight this bloody war to take over the Philippines. So all of this is before the Bolshevik Revolution. All of this is before the threat of communism. I think it's important to know this so that we won't be deluded any time somebody says, we're going to this country for this reason. We're militarily intervening here for this reason. We need a $300 billion military budget for this reason. I mean, this time we must know, right? Governments lie. They lie like mad. I mean, I.F. Stone, the great journalist, who's dead now, but, the great journalist along with Haywood Broun, George Seldes, great journalists of the 20th century. I.F. Stone, when he gave talks to journalism schools, would say to the students of journalism, he'd say, really, he says, you really only have to know two words as a starting point and never forget them, governments lie. And of course, all citizens should understand that. And as I say, you look before 1917 and see what we've done. You look after 1989, the Soviet Union is gone, and what are we doing? Are we now a peaceful country, retiring, and planting tomatoes and being like Sweden, don't bother us, we won't bother you, there's no communist threat in the world. No, we're everywhere. Military bases everywhere, destroyers everywhere, battleships everywhere, military bases in the middle of the Pacific, military bases in the Mediterranean, everywhere. And we're fighting wars, right? Almost immediately, right? After the Soviet Union is disintegrated, there's the Gulf War against Iraq. Well, we don't have Stalin, we don't have communism, but we have Saddam Hussein, right? One of the great military threats in the world. No, really. He might one day develop one atomic bomb. No, really. That was a talk. He might develop an atomic bomb. The United States has 20,000 atomic bombs, right? But it's amazing what you can put over on a gullible public. You know, how you can create monsters and MacArthur said, you just create hysteria, create monsters. And so we fight the Gulf War, and at the end of it, we've killed, we don't know how many, 100,000 or so Iraqis. We haven't killed dictators or tyrants, we've killed ordinary Iraqi people. We've killed conscript soldiers. We haven't killed Saddam Hussein. We killed Iraqi people. And then when you continue the sanctions as we're doing now, we're killing hundreds and hundreds of thousands more people. What's the excuse now? Now that communism here, what is the excuse? Saddam Hussein threatening the world? No. There's one thing that Saddam Hussein may be threatening, oil. It's not even that he's threatening to cut off oil supplies. There's no point in cutting off oil supplies. He has to sell oil in order to survive. But he might sell it at a price higher than we are willing to pay. Now, can you believe that we would be willing to go to war and kill huge numbers of people for the price of oil? Yes. At one point, Thomas Friedman, who is not exactly a radical critic of American foreign policy, writes for the New York Times at that point, and he says, we may be going to war over the price of gasoline. Occasionally those guys on that side say something sort of honest and true, and when they do, you have to pay attention to it. So it continues, the interventions, and all with humanitarian pretenses. And so we have to, if it's not communism, then we have to look for the reasons. And the reasons become, as soon as you put aside the pretense of that we're fighting against communism, we're fighting for humanitarian reasons, we're fighting for democracy, we're fighting for self-determination, as soon as you sort of cut through all of that, what are you left with? You're left with sort of old-time reasons, which are still true. Profit, money, oil, tin, rubber, sugar, profit, military contracts, and political power. I mean, it's not simply economic. There are other factors too. There are the things that drive presidential decisions very often, even if the presidents haven't thought through the economics of it. If you look at the tapes of LBJ, recently released, or tapes of John F. Kennedy recently released about the Vietnam War, you're startled. Because what you see is that Johnson is deciding whether we should plunge into this bloody war in Vietnam. And he knows it's going to be bloody. And he's making a decision based on his political fortunes. Because he's saying, yes. And his friend Richard Russell, not exactly a liberal progressive, Richard Russell of Georgia, is saying, but Russell is sort of looking and says, why would we go into Vietnam? Why would we? And, and uh, Because Russell hasn't talked recently to the oil and tin and rubber interests, but he's asking this question, and John is saying, "I know, you know, it's too, you know, people will die and so on," but then he says, "But you know, if I don't, I might be impeached, mightn't I?" "You mean you're willing to go to war and shed all this blood to prevent your impeachment, your political fortunes?" And the answer is yes. I mean, it's hard for, you know, American citizens brought up the way we are and having a kind of naive belief in our political leaders to think that they would be willing to sacrifice the lives of huge numbers of people for political gain. But leaders all over the world do that. I mean, you know, what I'm saying about the United States is true of imperial powers all through history, imperial powers everywhere. The United States is not unique in all of these things that have been done to other countries. All the other empires have done that to other places. Just the United States comes last upon the world scene and is the biggest and most powerful and does the most, you see. Kennedy... contemplating in 1963 the possible withdrawal of American troops from Vietnam, but saying, "Well, I think we ought to wait until the election." Really? Really? You look at the Kennedy tapes. The election. I mean, that's how you're going to decide whether we should have troops in Vietnam or not troops in Vietnam, get involved in Vietnam or not get involved in Vietnam, depending on the election? And you get, this is a continuous thread. If you look at Bush on the eve of the Gulf War and Bush's aide, Sununu, do you remember him? He's sort of, you know, hard to forget that name. Sununu. He's saying, you know what, we need something to happen. We need something to boost the political fortunes of Bush. I'm, as you can see, paraphrasing, but it's very much something like that. So yes, there's economic interest in this, and there's politics, and there's a military industrial complex, and all of that. And it continues, and no more communism, but we have to get down to the bare essentials and realize that ultimately it's a class phenomenon. Ultimately, it's the profits of the rich in the world versus the lives and the fortunes of the poor people in the world. Yes, in the United States, but the poor people and the victims all over the world. And so that gives us an enormous responsibility. That gives all of us an enormous responsibility to do what we can to resist this, to organize against this, to reject the two parties that represent this, no matter what, you know. Remember, all the terrible things we've done to other people in the world have been bipartisan, Democrats and Republicans. You know, whatever difference you can find between Gore and Bush on this or that, and yes, you can find differences. There's also the fact that on the matter of war and militarism and military budgets, the Democratic and Republicans have been united in all of these things and remain united and are proud that they are united. So we have a responsibility to build a movement in this country to resist militarism and to insist that the enormous wealth of this country, which has been used to profit the war contractors and to do bad things in the world, that huge sum of money, plus more huge sums of money to come out of just taxation of the super rich in this country, that all that wealth of this country should be used for the things that people need, for universal health care, for schools, for child care, for housing for everybody, to do the things that are fundamentally decent things to do when a country is as rich as ours. So, yeah, we have a lot of work to do. And it's a good idea to get involved, whether it's with Food Not Bombs or any one of the other 100 organizations that send me mail every day. And, you know, whatever it is that appeals to you, but somebody, get together with other people who are doing good things and, you know, people that you like and people who sing songs and tell jokes and go to the movies. But get together with such people and, you know, when enough of such get-togethers take place all over this country, you know, we will have, even though you can't see it at this point, even though you don't know what will happen, but that's how great movements become alive out of the little things that people do. You have to do those little things that you do with a kind of hope and faith that at some point it will coalesce with little things that a million other people do. And as a result, we might have a better society and a better world. Thank you. There's a question period. You don't have to stay for the question period.